This is Festival Showcase, a weekly program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk to the musicians, composers, conductors, and the movers and shakers from the Aspen Music Festival and School during the festival season. That's every Friday at 2:30 p.m. I'm your host, Chris Moore. Funding for Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio is generously provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. Today, we start with a conversation with pianist Simona Dinnerstein, who will play a varied recital including everyone from François Couperin to Philip Glass on August 8th. We'll also hear from conductor James Gaffigan, who navigates the insane rhythms of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and then joins pianist Nikolai Lugansky for Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. That's this Sunday afternoon. And finally, we talk with rising opera luminary David Weigel, who stars as Figaro in Mozart's most beloved opera. First, here's pianist Simona Dinnerstein. Simona, a lot of times I like to jump right into the upcoming concert, but in your case, if you don't mind, some of your story as a musician is fascinating to me. For one thing, I didn't realize that you had actually hired out a recital hall at Carnegie Hall and invited the reviewers in. And I certainly didn't know that your CD, which I was familiar with, of the Goldberg Variations, went up to the top of the charts. So can you say just a little bit about what was involved in you making that recording of the Goldberg Variations? Because that didn't come easily for you.
Well, I had learned the Goldbergs back in, I think, 2001, when I was actually pregnant with my son, Adrian. Mm. And at a certain point, I decided I'd like to record the piece. I felt that I had something to say. I'd been performing it. I wanted to document it. But I didn't, at that point, have a manager or a record company. And this was in 2005 that I recorded it. Mm-hmm. So I, at that time, there really weren't crowdsource funding campaigns.
Right.
So I asked a few friends of mine who had been very encouraging over the years if they might support this because I didn't have the funds to do it myself. And they all came together, three people, and found a fantastic producer who has been my producer ever since then, Adam Abeshouse. And we went and recorded it at the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Mm-hmm. And when Adam started to edit the recording, I sent it out to a few different people in the music industry. And there was a lot of interest in the recording, and people wanted to hear me play the variations live. And so I knew that I needed to play it in concert in New York. And a very strange thing happened, which was that right at that moment, a man that I did not know called me from Israel. And he'd heard about my Goldberg Variations somehow or other through a friend and said he wanted to help me out. Anyway, he wound up renting Weill Hall at Carnegie Hall for me to give my concert. I did that debut recital in 2005. A lot of people came, and it got a really wonderful review and led to me being taken on by management. Mm-hmm. And then about 2 years later, 2007, Telarc decided to commercially release the recording that I had made in 2005. Mm-hmm. The week that it came out, there was a big article in the New York Times about me and on Slate as well, which was a big online magazine at that time. And the CD went to number one on the classical Billboard chart. And then from there, my whole life changed, really.
Well, yeah, no kidding. The biggest surprise for me was that you heard the Glenn Gould recording when you were, what, 13 or something?
Yeah,
you were very young. And it made a huge impression on you. And yet, not having known that and having heard you play it live and also having heard and loved the recording, I would say that that recording of Glenn Gould's might as well have been orbiting around Pluto for all it affected you, in the sense that you sounded nothing like him eventually. I mean, you eventually clearly found a completely different approach to the Goldbergs.
Yes. I mean, I think that my love and sort of adoration and worship of Glenn Gould kept me from feeling comfortable with Bach myself for a long time. And when I decided to learn the Goldberg Variations, I had to actually stop listening to him. And I listened to another recording that had a very profound influence on me, which was by the jazz musician Jacques Lussier. And he recorded it with his trio. I never had heard anything like that before. And I think that it made me realize that there were so many different directions that the music could take. So I started to kind of try to strip things down and not think about what I had heard before and just go to the music itself, to the text, to the score. I tried playing it many, many different ways, and it's one of these enormous pieces of music where if you play variation one in a certain way, it means that variation 30 is going to be a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so if you change something, it affects everything else. There's a kind of butterfly effect in this,
yes,
in this piece.
Uh-huh.
And I tried doing it so many different ways, and certain things started to feel like they made sense, and other things started to feel like they didn't make sense. And eventually, it took a shape that seemed what the music was saying to me, and I was so surprised that it was so different than mm-hmm. how I had thought of it, you know, years before. And even now that when I play it, because I still perform it, it's changed shape again. So I think that it's kind of an organic thing, that almost like the music is living outside of yourself and you just keep mm-hmm. on discovering it. And it turned out that how the music spoke to me was quite different than how it spoke to Glenn Gould.
Let's take some of what you just said and bring it into the concert that is coming up next week. Now this time, no Bach, but you have François Couperin, for example. Have you used that same approach to learning new pieces? Or Philip Glass, who's so famous, and there are so many recordings of his out there, does there come a point where you have to throw away all recordings and everything you know and start over again in the same way you did with Bach?
Yes, I really try to do that with everything that I play. I think that it's really important to have a clear response to the music, which is not based on hearsay. Of course, we're all influenced by a kind of oral tradition.
Right.
But the imagination it required to make a piece of music come alive off of the notes that are written down on a page, I think, needs to come from the musician who's doing it. I learned quite a lot by talking to Philip Glass, actually, because in many ways he has very little memory of the process of writing a piece after mm-hmm. he wrote it. And I think that's because he also performs the music that he plays. So he realizes that music is alive in the moment of performance, and it doesn't mm-hmm. just exist as a written document. And Bach performed the music that he wrote. He played it, you know, not in the kind of concert hall that we do now, but he used the music as a musician who plays. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really interesting thing to think about as a musician, is how does it change in the moment of performance? And for me, with this particular program, which is a really interesting program that jumps around time periods and also doesn't have any pause between the pieces of music.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it creates a kind of continuous suite of pieces. The way that I think of the music is very much influenced by the music that I just played and the music that I'm about to play.
Mm-hmm.
So if I played, say, the Schumann Arabesque in a different program, I probably would play it differently than if I was playing it in this program where it's right between Couperin and Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really feel this kind of continuum that's happening between those composers.
Can you find some words to try to describe that? Because I'm trying to look at these and say, what does Couperin have in common with Glass, and what do either of them have in common with the nervous romanticism of Schumann? They're very different musical personalities, and yet you're saying that you're creating a flow among all of them as if it were a suite.
I think that though stylistically they are very different, the obsessive churning over of the same idea is something that all three composers, as well as Satie, who's the fourth composer on the program,
mm-hmm.
that all of those composers explore a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Schumann is so repetitive.
Yes.
And there's a reason for that. I think that that's really important in his music. And with Glass, when I've spoken to him about his music, he's quite open to different tempi, different articulations, different phrasing. What he's not open to is taking away the repeats.
Hmm.
And that's because architecturally, it's extremely important to him. And I think mm-hmm. that in Schumann, that I feel that it's the same. Sometimes you can think, oh, do you really need this repeat? But it changes the whole shape of the piece if you take away a repeat. And it's a very human desire to revisit something.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're not electronically looping the music. It's changing in time. It's changing as you're playing it. Even if you're playing the same passage, even if you intend to play it exactly the same way, it'll be different because it's in a different moment in time and you're different and everything's changed in the room and inevitably something is different about how you play it. So I think that that's something that is really the thread running through this whole program, which is the idea of patterns that repeat.
When a pattern repeats, you said it's inevitable, you're going to have to, just the way you're breathing or anything would make it a little bit different, but I'm sure you're conscious of wanting to make it a little bit different too as you prepare a work.
Definitely. I think it's very important that things are different, but there's also a danger of too much artifice in it.
Yes.
So I tend to have a plan, but I also am open to what may happen in that performance, that it might change. Actually, it's one of the good things and the bad things about being a pianist is that you're always playing on a different instrument.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes that can be extremely frustrating. But on the other hand, it also is really interesting because it means that something different is going to happen. You're going to discover something different about the music because of the sound and the touch of that particular instrument. And sometimes a piano teaches you something about music that you didn't know before. Or some things work in a really great way and other things are not going to work as well. And so you have to kind of adjust your performance to that instrument.
I wanted to ask you, too, it's interesting that you're choosing not to have any silences between the music. Because when I've heard you perform in the past, there always seems to be a silence that is behind the performance. Just me as a listener, I hear something and I feel a certain quiet in me as I listen to you perform. How important is the silence in music for you? Or am I just way off the track here when I ask you that question?
No, I think that's a really great observation. I mean, I think that silence is extremely important, and I'm glad that you have heard that when I've played, because I do think that sound comes out of silence, and it goes back into silence, and that's a part of the music, is the silence that surrounds it. In this program, there is not silence between the pieces, which is quite interesting to me. However, there is some space between them. And in fact, there's a little tiny little improv, very little thing that I do between a couple of the pieces. And initially, when I played the program, I played it without an intermission at all. And then I realized that I'm getting older. I need an intermission.
You need to flop your hands around the back.
And especially when I'm playing in altitude, I'm probably going to need an intermission. But yes, here in this case, the silence happens before the first note and after the whole kind of suite, like before the intermission. That's where the silence happens.
Well, Simona, I definitely appreciate you taking the time to come in here. I know we had to do a little juggling with your schedule because suddenly there was another rehearsal needed and everything else. So thank you for making the time to come in. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been hearing from pianist Simona Dinnerstein, who will play a varied recital including everyone from François Couperin to Philip Glass on August 8th. Next up, conductor James Gaffigan, who keeps the festival orchestra on its toes through Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and then joins pianist Nikolai Lugansky for Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini this Sunday afternoon. This weekend's concert, let's talk about the first work on the program, Aeriality, by a composer most people don't know from Iceland, Anna Thorvaldsdóttir. Obviously, you've studied the score.
Yeah.
And maybe we can start with that because that's the one that almost nobody will know anything about.
Yeah. Aeriality, it's a play of words between aerial and reality. And so often these composers try to experiment with spectral chords and kind of large waves of sound, and most composers try to fool the audience from what they're hearing, or they don't know the combination of instruments. And she actually succeeds in doing this. I find her to be extremely talented. This piece was written about 10 years ago, I think 2010 or 11. This succeeds in using the orchestra in a very revolutionary way, where I find a lot of composers push the boundaries and they don't often succeed. I don't mean to be harsh in saying that. I just find it's a difficult thing to write for a large orchestra and with huge forces. And I think she very much gets the different colors of the strings, winds, brass, percussion, and what they could do in a realistic sense. So I think the piece is crafted in a very beautiful way. It's just the right length for the audience, especially an audience member experiencing music like this for the first time. It's waves of sound that are masked in very strange harmonies. And also, sometimes the notes move at such a slow rate from one step to another. And that's very unusual. And like I said, she succeeds in kind of creating this weightless, airy environment in which we're flying over a landscape.
And then after that, we have something that is much, much more conservative and a little bit east of Iceland. And of course, that's the Rachmaninoff. You mentioned that you have just recently recorded this piece. These are the variations on a theme by Paganini. What strikes you about it that you think a lot of performances may miss, whether it be the pianist or the conductor?
That's a great question. I think Rachmaninoff leads, he leaves us the perfect amount of information and instruction. And I think the issue that most people have with this piece is the pianist or the conductor takes too many liberties when they're not necessary, because I think the music is so beautiful and so pristine on its own. It's so well crafted that if you just follow the instructions of what the composer gave us, we would have a much easier time with it. I mean, not technically, of course, it's a difficult piece. But I find there are beautiful orchestrational moments that are just masked because people, either they don't spend enough rehearsal time on it, or they figure, oh, everyone knows this piece, it'll be fine. For me, that's the worst mentality to have about such a popular piece.
Well, that's the one you, I think, most need to say, here's something that I've discovered. Not that you have to go for newness for its own sake.
But newness for its own sake is kitsch.
But to bring people into the moment of, of what the music is offering would seem to be
It's really
important.
And it's so clean. It's so clear. For some reason, in the 40s and 50s, especially the 50s and 60s, Rachmaninoff has become heavier and heavier, a kind of orchestral sound in our world. And I'm not sure why. I have a theory that it was maybe Stokowski, actually, or maybe the sound of Philadelphia, which we love so much, which blurs the lines. And Rachmaninoff himself loved this orchestra. But I think over time, it got a bit out of hand. And instead of being muscular and lean, it became fatty and lugubrious. But I think Rachmaninoff is a beautiful and well-crafted composer. I mean, his compositions are well-crafted and lean. And I think, of course, there are moments of sensuality and thick orchestration, but we have to celebrate those, not every single beautiful moment that comes along.
Right.
Sort of like hiking. I mean, you can't stop and smell every flower.
And then we go from there to Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which I've heard many, many, many times. I guess it's a very much part of the standard repertoire. But when I looked at the score a long time ago, it was like every measure is different. It would seem to me as though it would be just hard for the orchestra to just count out when they're supposed to make their entrances and things like that.
Yeah.
Are these challenges that are way less than I think they are for an orchestra of the caliber of what we find here in Aspen?
No, I still think it's quite difficult. But I think that the orchestra level has raised so much in the last 30 years that young people are expected to play this well. And mixed meter is a standard diet for us today, whereas I think, you know, in the 40s and 50s, it was very difficult to play this repertoire. But I think young people are being trained in conservatory and in youth orchestras to play pieces like this and Petrushka. So I think Sakra is another example of a very well-crafted piece. It's amazing to think that this would premiere in 1913, over 100 years ago. It's insane, actually. And it's still revolutionary. It still shocks audiences around the world. It still shocks me every time I study it because I find new hidden things in it every time I come back to the score.
I know that you do a lot of opera conducting. And I wonder if your experience as an opera conductor, where you have to be very obvious with your hand movements so that the singers can see you as well, does that help you when you're with a student orchestra as well to bring a lot of clarity to the podium?
Well, I think being an operatic conductor and being an orchestral conductor are two very, very different things in the sense that there are more people involved with opera and more people need your help. But at the same time, it doesn't make the gesture any different. I think the most important thing for an opera conductor is to be flexible and helpful for the singers, especially in the repertoire Verdi, Puccini, Wagner, Strauss. The key is really knowing when to help them and when to leave them alone. With a young orchestra, I find that it's dangerous to conduct differently. I was just in Verbier conducting the age of 14 through 18, and they were extraordinary, doing the Schumann Symphony No. 1 and you know, Brahms' Academic Festival Overture. It was shocking how incredible they were and how if you kind of speak down to them or if you conduct at them, I don't think they necessarily will play any better. Mm-hmm. So I find that as life goes on, I'm turning 40 this summer, I used to conduct much differently for youth orchestras, and now I find I conduct the same, if mm-hmm. it's Bavarian Radio or the Vienna Philharmonic or if it's the Aspen Festival Orchestra. Mm-hmm. The only thing different is I go a little slower in the rehearsal process. I take things apart in a much more intricate way with young people mm-hmm. because I think they deserve to learn the piece in a different way, and they deserve to have the time because I think many of them will be playing it for the first time. So I think opera doesn't necessarily help me conduct something like the Aspen Festival Orchestra, but I think it gives me a very open mindset into what human beings need at all different levels. And I think more and more the maestro myth is gone, you know, that I'm this kind of dictator and they're servants. You know, that's mm-hmm. far from the truth. We're all in this together. And I think the more they can trust me and the more I can trust them, that's when the magic happens. And I find it fascinating with young people. When I'm very clear with the gesture and I start taking it away, I realize they don't actually need it. And then you let them free. And mm-hmm. that's the most exciting thing about what I do is having all these talented people, young or old, in front of me, and they have something to offer. And if you keep them in a straitjacket, say, follow me, watch me here, that's not the way to make music.
I have to say that when I look at your history as a conductor, you have a surprising number of ties to the Rocky Mountain West. I saw you conduct the Colorado Symphony several times. Obviously, up here in Aspen, you got a lot of your training with David Zinman and yes. Murray Sidlin. I remember those days very, very well. And then you're conducting next year at the Santa Fe Opera. You'll be conducting Tristan and Isolde. So do you have a special fondness for the Rocky Mountain West, or is it just that these are the gigs you get?
Well, yeah. No, the gigs I get, those times are over because right. I have to be picky and
right.
I have to do things for my family and what's artistically most important to me. So I would say a quick answer to your question is I fell in love when I was 19 and I first came here to mm-hmm. Aspen as a student for 3 summers. David Zinman was so kind and open to me as a student. So were the whole faculty. And I met many agents in the business and many people, but David protected me from all that when I was young because mm-hmm. I could have mm-hmm. easily got swept up in conducting things I shouldn't have been at the age of 20 or 21. Mm-hmm. So I fell in love with Aspen because I was a New York City boy and I had never seen anything like this place.
Right.
And the friends that I made here, the memories I have being here and spending time with the faculty, Robert Spano, who's now music director, we had many dinners together, just talking until 3 a.m. with a bunch of conducting students about life and about music. And I'll never forget those evenings. And I just felt very, very safe here. And mm-hmm. I felt like I could make mistakes on the stage. Mm-hmm. Even though it was a huge, prestigious place, it was a workshop ground for all of us, composers, students, conductors. So that's one thing. I fell in love with the nature. Santa Fe, I was there last summer, and it was just magical. And the level of that mm-hmm. place in the institution. And I did Ariadne off Naxos, and I'm coming back for Tristan, as you said, and this will be a huge event because not only will it go on till 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning because yes. we have to wait for the sun to go down, mm-hmm. but it will attract the real Wagnerites out there. And we have mm-hmm. the most extraordinary cast and director. So I'm very excited to go back there. And the Colorado Symphony was beginning of my career. And they were one of the first professional orchestras I went to. And I've been there a couple times. I had to cancel the last time because my first child was being born, or second child, I can't remember, but there was a birth.
Yes.
So, but I hear they're doing great, and they have a wonderful music director who was also assistant conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra. Mm-hmm. It's Brett, right?
And yes, Brett Mitchell.
He's a lovely guy, extremely talented, and has a good vision. So, yeah, I think this part of the world is special, and as an American, I mean, the Grand Tetons, too, and mm-hmm. I was at Vail with Philadelphia Orchestra, and it's a very special place. And there's mm-hmm. nowhere like it in Europe, and as an American, I take pride in these national parks, and the fact that my kids get to see it is really special. I mean, I'm just so excited to go up to Maroon Bells, and I have to do that every time I'm here, no matter what the weather is like.
Right.
So, but in general, Aspen was good to me, and I want to be good to Aspen. And this training ground is so essential to young people.
Well, it's early in the morning for both of us. I think we've covered some beautiful territory. James, I'm so grateful that you're able to make it in.
I'm happy.
We will look forward to seeing you conduct and hearing you conduct, of course, on Sunday.
Great. Thank you. I'm really excited.
We've been talking with conductor James Gaffigan, who will perform Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini this Sunday afternoon. Finally, let's talk with the young and vibrant David Weigel, who sings the title role in Mozart's Marriage of Figaro at the Wheeler Opera House August 13th, 15th, and 17th. Well, David, I was interviewing a few weeks ago at Berkeley, and he said that there are certain roles that he hires people to bring in, and I'm guessing you're probably one of them since you are the title role for the Marriage of Figaro.
Yeah. I'm actually fortunate enough. I work at the Lyric Opera Chicago. I'm a member mm-hmm. of the Ryan Opera Center. And over the last couple of years, they've been able to work out something where they allow some of us that are in the ensemble at Lyric to come here to Aspen to sing. And I was mm-hmm. fortunate enough to be able to coordinate with my schedule to be able to come out here to sing Figaro.
The Marriage of Figaro, I mean, a lot of people consider the perfect opera, the greatest opera of all time. One of my friends called it the greatest accomplishment of the human species. So it gets a lot of high reviews. Is that daunting for you?
Well, I do agree. I think that it is one of the greatest accomplishments out there. On paper, I do think it's the perfect opera. I personally mm-hmm. do like Don Giovanni maybe a little bit more because it's maybe just the darkness of it. It's a little
right.
grittier.
Mm-hmm.
But Da Ponte's libretto is definitely stronger, I think, for Nozze. So it could easily be viewed as the perfect opera. But I think what you alluded to about the comedy and the humanity of it doesn't make it quite as daunting because mm-hmm. Figaro is such a complete character. He really is an everyman. We can relate to him on so many different levels. He's very clever. However, he's become a little complacent at the beginning of the opera. And while he comes up with all these wonderful plans in order to try and outsmart the Count and protect his wife-to-be Susanna, he fails a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he really encapsulates what it's like to be a human. You think you're on top of something, but something comes around and just knocks your feet out from under you, and then you have to start all over again. And he's constantly coming up with plans and being a very intelligent person, but then someone else steps in and is actually smarter. Susanna especially.
Susanna, right.
She definitely, I think, is the smartest person and the catalyst for the entire opera. So while it is daunting to tackle a role that is so iconic, it's such a challenge, and that makes it so enjoyable because he's such a complete human being.
Mozart's opera, and this is not the only one that this is true of, but they're in some ways the ultimate ensemble pieces.
Yes.
Which now, when you get together with a group of singers, you may have perhaps a stronger voice, say, than Susanna, just in terms of the sheer decibels that you put out there. How much of the ensemble work are you doing just to make sure you're all balanced together and that you got the rhythm, that you got the comedic moments and things like that? You must really have to rely heavily on your co-singers.
Yes, absolutely. And those are the most joyous moments in the opera. The Act Two mm-hmm. finale is quite possibly the most perfect part of the most perfect opera.
Mm-hmm.
And today, actually, with Maestro Jane Glover, we were working on such a thing about making sure that our consonants were together. We were making the same vowels, that we were really listening. And when we have those ensemble moments, we try to pick out who is the important singer to be listening to, who really has the melody, and who of us, for lack of a better term, almost become backup singers at that moment. So we make sure that we tune our ears to be able to match that person's volume, to make sure we are always listening for that. It's not the same as choral singing, where we need to blend our voices because mm-hmm. we are multiple soloists together.
Right.
So it's more about making sure that our vowels, our consonants, our rhythmic integrity, that is all together, and that we're listening for the melody that is coming and going out of various voice parts.
Well, David, thank you so much. I know you had to rush over here from a rehearsal, in fact, to even get into the station to do the interview. So we all look forward to that last week of the festival to see you and Susanna and all the other people that are singing alongside you in The Marriage of Figaro.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Our festival showcase this week comes to a conclusion with our interview with baritone David Weigel, who sings the title role in Mozart's Marriage of Figaro at the Wheeler Opera House August 13th, 15th, and 17th. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk to the musicians, composers, conductors, and the movers and shakers from the Aspen Music Festival and School during the festival season, Fridays at 2:30 p.m. Funding for Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio is generously provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. I'm your host, Chris Moore. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next week.